Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And I'm here with my co-host today, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Monday, September 24th, and it is still 2018. Good afternoon, Dave.
It's true. It's another manic Monday.
Yes, it is. I'll tell you what, it truly is amazing, everything that's going on. I don't even know how anybody can keep up with it or really know what they're saying, because as soon as you say something, it's different. And, of course, that's all, to me, I believe, all by design. All, you know, it's what it's intended for, and that's why they do what, and that's how it is. You know, they got to keep you going from, you know, from A to B to C to D, and then they'll get you right back to A and start it all over again. But anyway, that's what they're doing with gold anyway. We started out with a decent day, pressure later on in the day, and we're still hovering around the 1200 level. Barely little movement on the day. We had a high of 1205. Silver was down a penny at 1434. Platinum was down a buck at 830. Palladium was up 8 at 1066. We have the USDX today is trading stronger by 0.02 at 94.23. Crude oil was up a buck 50 at 72.28. And I think Brent was over 80, didn't it? I thought I saw where
yes.
It was over 80 a day, the first time since 2014. So, you know, and folks, you can bet on it's going to 100. I mean, that's how they manipulate these markets. They plant the seeds, they come in, they run the price up, and, you know, they make billions and billions of dollars. So bet on $100 oil here coming to a town near you. Paper markets today, a little bit of pressure, yeah, barely, based on, let's see where the numbers are today. Please bear with me. We have the Dow is down triple digits earlier in the day. And, you know, when they don't want you to know this stuff, they just don't allow your screens to come up, right?
Yeah, it was down 169 total. Actually 181 now and after hours trading.
Yeah, I have 181 on the Dow at 26,561. The NASDAQ was up 6 at 7,993. The S&P was down 10 at 29.19. 10-year yield 3.08%, up 0.01. Hong Kong was the biggest loser overnight, and it was only down by 1.62%. Everything is still the same. A little pressure on Bitcoin overnight, and you know, certainly all eyes are on the Kavanaugh soap opera, I guess, and you know, Rosenstein, that soap opera that's going on. So, you know, it's pretty much has covered up everything else. Of course, President Trump today was at the UN, and he does his speech on the 26th, I believe. I didn't know he was going to be there today. I thought his speech 4 days. He's going to be there 4 days?
Yep.
And but his speech is on the 26th, I believe.
Wednesday.
Is it Wednesday? And that's the same day the Federal Reserve, I guess, will release their information as far as the rate hike or yay or nay on that. There's a lot of things going on this week. Kavanaugh hearings are set for Thursday, as Rosenstein. And, you know, Rosenstein was supposed to go to the White House today. I guess he did. I haven't been able to follow it much on, you know, just a little bit here and there. And I thought to myself, well, you know, the Kavanaugh hearings were supposed to be today. So, and now it's rescheduled for Thursday, the same day. So I figured that's a little bit of a media play just to keep a lot of attention. I think more people would tune in for Rosenstein than Kavanaugh. So we'll have to see how the media plays it. But anyway, that's just my opinion on what's going on, and who knows what might happen from now until Thursday. His speech, Trump is supposed to stress about his dedication to the U.S. While competing with Western allies for an advantage on trade. Today, I believe he spoke mostly about our drug problem, the world drug problem. And it's been about, 12 months since his last visit to the U.N., Dave?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you want to add anything to that, or no?
Well, you know, we know that, you know, since he's pulled out of the Iranian nuclear deal and, you know, we're now engaged in some trade issues with, you know, a number of countries in Europe and North America and Asia, you know, there's been a lot of tension with some of the, particularly the allies abroad. And, you know, he's long been critical of the UN. President Trump delivered a warning shot over the weekend by, you know, saying that the world body had not lived up to its potential. You know, if there's still an end game in the evolving Trump doctrine on foreign policy, then it's that the president will not subordinate American interests on the world stage. You know, whether we're talking about economic or military or political gain. You know, Nikki Haley, who's our U.S. ambassador to the U.N., told reporters in a preview of the president's visit that he will focus, you know, very much on the U.S., its role, and the relationships it wants to build.
Well, I guess he had dinner last night with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe last night. And I think today I saw President Trump and the South Korean President Moon Jae-in. I think they had a meeting today. I saw them sitting together. I don't know if that was from
that was
a previous.
Scheduled. No, that was scheduled, scheduled for this afternoon. Yeah.
Okay. So, and I'm sure their topic was the U.S. And I think I actually heard him say that they are going to try and schedule another summit with North Korea. And but you know, you hear a lot, and I'm not quite sure where it is that North Korea, even though they're willing to tear apart some of their missile sites and so forth, they haven't really talked about denuclearization yet. But this is something, Dave, that my understanding is going to go on till 2021, 2022 or something like that.
Time will tell. that's the only thing I think we can say.
Oh, geez, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, some U.S. officials are concerned that South Korea's eagerness to restore relations with the North could, you know, reduce sanction pressures on Kim Jong-un's government, thus hampering, you know, our efforts in particular to negotiate a nuclear accord. Now, when President Trump addresses the General Assembly, and he's going to chair for the first time the UN Security Council, the stated topic of non-proliferation of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons reportedly will be top of the agenda. The subject was apparently going to be Iran, but that could have allowed Iranian President Rouhani to attend the session. Something that the U.S. officials did not want because it would have been potentially awkward for Trump in particular. While he's not seeking to meet with Rouhani, he is open. He's stated to be open to talking with the Iranian leader if it's requested. Another interesting note is that Vladimir Putin is not expected to be in New York this week.
Well, he doesn't normally attend these UN meetings, does he?
No, he did last year when did you he? Know, yeah, there was that was for, you know, probably his attendance there was, you know, a sidebar to a prearranged meeting with Trump to discuss, well, whatever they discussed. Doesn't look like it this year anyway.
Not this year. All right. Well, the housing market, again, is signaling that it's in a bubble. And, you know, the big question is it happening again in 2018? You know, we've seen the housing market, and I'm sure in a lot of areas people see houses being built. It's been one of the brighter spots for the U.S. economy. Home prices, especially in the hottest markets on the East and West Coast, have been soaring. And it's interesting, I had a client today, a new client, and he's in New Jersey, and we were talking about the housing market. And I said, yeah, you see a lot of building going on. He says, well, what you have around here is you have a lot of older homes being refurbished. And I thought to myself, you know, it's the same thing that's happening here around this area in Berlin. I mean, you go down this one street, you have, you know, the homes that are 100 years old, and they're all being, you know, refurbished. They're you know, and I thought, I just thought that was interesting that I don't know how they're priced in, if they're considered new homes or when they're purchased, or, you know, I don't know what type of impact that would have on the housing market. Home sellers are cutting prices at a pace that we haven't seen since the last recession. And, you know, that is definitely a major red flag for the economy. There are several observers that home sellers are slashing at the highest rate in at least 8 years. The heat is coming off the U.S. housing market with the soaring home prices. And so they have to cut the prices in order to sell them. And, you know, I've always said your home value is whatever someone is willing to pay for it. So.
Yes, it is. You know, it's interesting. Prices are being cut the fastest in the markets that were once the hottest. California is a prime example, because that's exactly what happened during the subprime mortgage meltdown in 2008. You know, according to Redfin, who's a housing brokerage company, more than one out of every four homes for sale in America had a price drop within the most recent month. You know, in the 4 weeks ended September 16th, more than a quarter of the homes listed for sale had a price drop, and that's the highest level since Redfin began tracking that metric in 2010. You know, we've never seen a number anywhere close to that in a 30-day period. Now, of course, the reason why prices are being dropped is because, as Melody mentioned, homes aren't selling. You know, supply of homes available for sale is shooting up. You know, that's good news for buyers, but really bad news for sellers. The question is this just an adjustment, or is this the beginning of another crisis for the housing market?
Well, you know, just like what we had in 2008, you have millions of families that really stretch themselves. They get into things that they really can't afford, or they can afford in the beginning, but they don't watch their budget. And next thing you know, they're way over their head in everything. So if there's another economic downturn, you're going to see a lot of Americans losing their jobs. And then again, you're going to see these mortgage defaults rise to some stunning heights. Now, you know, we look at the middle class. You know, we've been following this for years and years and years. It's getting smaller and smaller. You have families. We report on it all the time. There's numerous reports where families barely making it from month to month. They're using their credit cards. They're not saving. You know, if there was an emergency, anywhere from 500 to, you know, 1,000, you know, they're in deep trouble. But you have the cost of living that continues to rise. The only thing that isn't rising are paychecks. And that is resulting in this huge middle class squeeze. So the general burden of this American worker is just the daily task of squaring the difference between the booming economy that's reported by the government bureaus and the dreary economy that's really reported in their biweekly paychecks, Dave.
Well, you know, how is it, Melody, that the economy's been growing for nearly a decade straight, but the average worker see no meaningful increase in their income? I mean, have workers really been sprinting in place all this time? And how do they end up in this ridiculous situation? The fact is, for the basic American worker, the American brand of a centrally planned economy, as it were, thank you, Federal Reserve, it just doesn't pay. The dual impediments of fake money and regulatory madness apply exactions which can't be overcome. I mean, there are claims to the fruits of one labors long before they've been earned. You know, in short, the economy's been rigged. The value that workers produce flows to Washington and Wall Street primarily, and there it's siphoned off and misallocated to, you know, to the cadre of officials, cronies, and big bankers. What's left is spent, you know, merely to keep the lights on, the car running, the food on the table. And unfortunately, things aren't likely to get much better soon. So if home prices in particular continue to fall like they've started to, that's going to put even more pressure on the system, on working families, and it won't be too long before we reach the breaking point.
No, and I mean, this is, again, it's going to happen again, and people are just, I don't know. I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know why people do it. You know, they're conditioned to do it. You know, these, look what you, all these commercials that are just being bombarded through the internet, through your phones, through television, through, you know, everywhere. And in this era of financial service innovation, you know, money remains still one of the great stressors in our lives. You know, about 5% of all Americans with checking accounts rack up more than 50% of all the country's overdraft and bounce check fees. This is a $35 billion income stream for the banks. Even after Dodd-Frank, you know, needless to say, those 5% of Americans are precisely the people who can least afford to pay dozens of fees per year at an average cost of $35 apiece. That's a lot of money for fees.
It adds up.
It certainly does. According to a new report from Nonfiction, 41% of Americans who earn over $200,000 a year have cried because they didn't have enough money.
Phew, that's pretty stark. I mean, we're desperate for help without knowing if we're being paid fairly. That in many ways is the bottom line. For example, 70% of women feel they're not paid what they deserve but have no access to salary evaluation services. But we also need help with budgeting and saving. We here at Financial Survival, you know, over the past year, we have a periodic segment about personal financial planning. We think it's important to provide information that, you know, the non-banking experts, the non-conflicted people who know what they're talking about, we can bring you their thoughts and ideas. You know, the financial services industry does a woeful job of addressing those problems. You know, and the problems just seem to be getting worse. Millennials, 40% more likely to overdraw their checking accounts if they use mobile payments on their phones. You know, mobile payment users were also more likely to make withdrawals from their retirement savings accounts and engage in high-cost borrowing activity. Existing budget tools just don't help. Millennials who use their mobile devices to track their spending are 25% more likely to overdraw their checking account. Pay attention, folks, not just to you, but to your kids, to their kids.
To their
dangerous
kids.
World out there.
Yes, to their kids and to their kids and to their kids. We'll be right back, ladies. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And we got all kinds of specials, end of the month specials, we're going to call them. So you want it, we've got it. And at low, low prices. And Silver Eagles 2018, Gold Eagles 2018s. No release dates yet on when they'll be changing over, but we got another good month before they do that. The U.S. Mint changing over their dies to 2019s, and it always puts a little pressure on some of those 1 ounce coins from the U.S. Mint and the American Eagle series. So get them now, get them while the prices are low. And visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, and announcements. I need to make this announcement. Well, I don't know if he likes me to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. So, Pastor Butch usually is with me on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but tomorrow he will not be. He has a little health issue. So I'm going to ask the listeners to make sure you put him in your prayers this evening for a quick recovery so he can get back to the program. And that's for Pastor Butch Paul. And he's going to try to be here tomorrow, but if he can't, I'm going to do the program with Beth. Her and I did the program Power Talks for almost a year for 200 programs, and so it'll be a little bit of a change. But prayers so that Butch can make it back tomorrow. So, going into the break, we're just getting ready, Dave, to talk about dark money's influence on elections and how that is growing. And there is a new show that is going to premiere on October 1st. Of course, timing is everything, you know, considering the election. So it kind of makes me wonder. But it's called Dark Money. And it follows Montana journalist John Adams as he follows this increasingly murky trail of money that is influencing the state's elections. Adams, former Capitol Bureau chief for the Great Falls Tribune and creator of the Montana Free Press, says in a release about the film, "When campaigns can receive unlimited sums from anonymous donors, it's not the people controlling the government. It's the government controlled by a corporation controlling the people," which is like super crazy Big Brother, but it's happening.
Yeah, we here at Discount Gold and Silver like to just bring these things to your attention. Some listeners who are also readers of our American Survival newsletter may recall a series we presented last fall about ways of improving our government to make it more not just transparent, but responsive, especially responsive to the people. Dark money, this big anonymous money, was one of them. And the series is being, or the show is being portrayed as a political thriller. You know, it examines one of the greatest present threats, or as mainstream media might say, the greatest existential threats to American democracy. And that's the influence of untraceable corporate money on our elections and elected officials. You know, the film takes viewers to Montana, as Melody mentioned. It's a front line in the fight to preserve fair elections nationwide. Follows this intrepid local journalist working to expose the real-life impacts of the U.S. Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision. Through this gripping story, Dark Money uncovers the shocking and vital truth of how American elections are really bought and really sold.
And you know what? You know, we also often, you know, it's like everybody knows, you know, we all know that these politicians are bought and paid for with the number of, you know, billions of dollars that's funneled into D.C. through these lobbyists and so forth. But sometimes it takes something like this to really open people's eyes, you know, those who don't pay much attention, and you know, they'll follow this little political thriller, and you know, and people wake up to it and say, so that's how it's done. And hopefully this story will bring perhaps how to stop it. I know draining the swamp is one way, but the swamp's much, much bigger than I think 99% of the people really realize. But, you know, we're going to go back to, you know, the Americans and, you know, their working pay, you know, how difficult it is to get by. And we talk about surprises that they're not prepared for a $500 or $1,000 surprise. And most of those surprises will come in the form of medical bills. So there's a growing interest, both in the media and on Capitol Hill. There's a bipartisan group of senators that's actually drafting legislation to crack down on the problem. I'm not sure what really can be done, but in an election where healthcare is top of mind, candidates could be missing an opportunity if they don't go back and, you know. And it is interesting, Dave, that you don't hear anyone really talk about healthcare anymore.
Well, you know,
very few.
Unexpected medical bills, it turns out, are the number one health cost problem people worry about. You know, it's according to a recent Kaiser Family Foundation tracking poll. That's ahead of all the cost issues that normally get more attention, you know, like deductibles, drug costs, and premiums. They're even a bigger concern than other family expenses, like paying the rent, mortgage, or, you know, utilities. Surprise medical bills affect a lot of people, it turns out. In the poll, 4 in 10, 40% of adults say they had a surprise bill from a doctor, hospital, or lab in the past year. An analysis of large employer health plans showed that a significant share of inpatient hospital admissions for their employees include bills from providers that aren't in the health plan's networks. That, you know, obviously leaves patients subject to higher cost sharing and potential additional bills from providers.
About 18%, Dave, of inpatient admissions result in non-network claims for patients that have large employer coverage. And, you know, it surprises a lot of analysts. And when enrollees choose in-network facilities, about 15% of these admissions include a bill from an out-of-network provider. And that can include your surgeon, anesthesiologist. There's always these surprise bills that have the elements of a perfect campaign issue. There is a victim, the consumer, and a villain, the providers. Even if they argue that the out-of-network providers are necessary to ensure adequate across these networks to shrink or to reduce these costs. So there is a range of candidates who will endorse to address the problem, but, you know, and it's not even it's not even the medical bills, it's the medical costs, the insurance. It's baffling. I can't wait to get my new increase. Oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, we will find out. You know, experts don't generally put surprise bills at the top of their list of problems in the health system. But people talk about these unexpected bills a lot, and not surprisingly, with a sense of outrage. You know, it's the candidates this year who aren't talking about it on the campaign trail, as you alluded to, Melody. And that's almost a certain missed opportunity, at least in a purely political sense. However, there are 6 weeks left until the election, so I guess anything can still happen.
Well, I mean, they're such a failure anyway. But, you know, we were talking about oil prices here in the beginning of the program, and that Brent was actually over $81 today. And I find this interesting because it's OPEC's, their latest forecast, they're saying that oil demand is going to continue to rise through at least 2040. And so they're effectively you know, rebuffing these analysts who released last year's edition that a project an earlier peak in the world's crude thirst. You know, in the cartel's 2018 World Oil Outlook, it was just released yesterday, they see global demand growing. So what's happening to the green people? What's happening to the electric cars? What's happening to, you think that you would just see a decrease with technology. So this report that they did, the World Oil Outlook, sort of underscores the lack of consensus on when the world's demand for oil, which is currently around 99 billion BPD and rising, will eventually crest.
Well, it goes to show that we're still hooked on that good old Texas tea.
Texas tea.
Yeah, God bless Ellie Mae, who died last week, I believe.
Oh, she did.
Speaking of the Beverly Hillbillies. Yeah, you know, the International Energy Agency, like OPEC, also sees global crude demand growing through at least 2040. But a recent analysis by another energy-focused risk advisory firm named DNVGL projects a peak a lot sooner in 2023. Royal Dutch Shell, with several caveats, has said a peak could occur by the late 2020s. And the central scenario in BP's long-term outlook released last February said a peak could get here as soon as the mid-2030s. So the middle scenario in Norwegian energy giant Equinor's latest collection of outlooks released in June sees a peak around 2030. So, you know, they're all like, you know, 2023 to 2040. With the median looks to be around 2030.
But you know what's interesting? OPEC is seeing that there might be a decline for several years after 2020. Of course, that might be a surging output from the U.S. shale boom. But, you know, they still look to see that it's going to peak in 2020s, in the late 2020s. So we'll have to see how this works out and, you know, if the... I see a lot of commercials on television for electric vehicles, a lot of advertisements on the computer pop up and so forth about the electric vehicles and so forth. So not sure if they're, you know, beginning to, you know what, Dave, the consumer is so controlled into what they purchase. It's, I guess they can take them whichever way they want. You know, if they want them to have electric vehicles, they're going to promote the electric vehicles, and you'll see a boom in that, you know, and vice versa. So it is a confusing world that we live, particularly when you have the outside influence of the advertising and how people are so easily manipulated by these advertisements. But
I don't think you can understate that melody. It's a controlled demand. It's so well put because it's so true, ladies and gentlemen. You know, we've you know, on one hand, I want to say, and I hope it doesn't come across as condescending, but we do got to be a little more critical about the choices we make. But a lot of that, but that's hard to do. Especially if you're online a lot, if you use social media, if you watch a lot of television, if you read a lot of magazines. The advertisements are overwhelming.
Yeah.
And, you know, while there are, you know, I agree that there do appear to be more choices now for the consumer in terms of, you know, hybrids and electric cars, the demand just isn't where you'd think it should be. And I think that's, you know, by choice of the major automakers in particular. And to a large extent by, you know, the companies that are part of the American Petroleum Institute Group and OPEC. This buys into their business model. Buy oil.
Yeah. And they give us just enough money to keep them going, right? So whatever they pay us, they get it back from us.
Oh, man.
Oh, no. But, you know, I saw this morning, I saw Theresa May being interviewed. She really looked tired. So she's having a little bit of a situation.
An Austrian hangover? Trust me, it's not from Austrian wine, you know, or Conservative Party's annual conferences later this month. She went to Salzburg last week, seeking buy-in from Europe's leaders for her highly controversial Checkers plan. You know, instead, she got humiliation and disaster. You know, the so-called Checkers plan was always unacceptable to the Brexiteers in May's cabinet. I mean, we know that both her Brexit secretary and her foreign secretary resigned this summer rather than sign on to it. You know, as such, it was always going to be hard to get it through the UK Parliament. Now, Europe's other leaders have made it clear that the plan's even less acceptable to the EU.
Yeah, which doesn't really make sense. She's just being, I think she's being told, you know, what to do and so forth. I mean, her whole, when she took office in 2016, there was a single mandate, and that was to deliver this workable Brexit. And you have the UK's ties to Europe, especially along the Irish border, are far too complex and interconnected just to easily disentangle. Can you imagine if they were using the euro also, how more difficult it would be?
Wow.
And also, a no-deal hard Brexit would be bad for Europe and disastrous for the UK, despite her continued assertions that it would be preferable to a bad deal. So, you know, I mean, the Europeans are kind of like our country, where their masters are kicking the can down the road. Maybe all governments are now becoming masters at kicking the can down the road. But it's kind of increasingly hard to see how they're going to be able to kick this one any further. I think the deadline is what, next?
Next March.
Next March.
Yeah. Coming soon. What's that? Just a little more than 6 months away.
How about that?
You know, and May's biggest problem is that, you know, she herself is consistently ruled out a second referendum, as some members of her own party, much less other parties in Parliament, have been calling for. You know, on the other hand, her political career has already lasted longer than, you know, most people thought it would. That's largely thanks to, you know, no credible alternative. But May's now lost a lot of credibility all by herself, coming back not just empty-handed, but with almost like, you know, don't come back, with the plans you came to Salzburg with this time. You know, it looks like we're closing in on the worst-case scenario for Brexit negotiations. You know, that's where positions become entrenched, goodwill evaporates, and brinkmanship leads to disaster. Oh, boy. Good luck hitting that March 2019 to our friends in Britain.
So it'll kind of be interesting to see what really happens after March 2019.
Yeah.
You know, And I think we're heading into a break. I think we're past a break. I didn't hear the music, so let's go ahead and talk about Russia until we know. And 1 week after a Russian plane was accidentally shot down by Syrian missiles, remember, folks, Russia has launched, is going to supply the Syrian army with sophisticated S-300 surface-to-air missiles. Israel has asked the Russians for many years to avoid supplying these missiles to Syria because it could limit the Israeli Air Force freedom of operation in Syria. And the Russian announcement threatens to break the coordination mechanism between the two countries in Syria. And it could also unravel what was thought to be close relationships between Russia and President Putin and Israel Netanyahu. And Dave, tell us some of the latest developments.
Well, you know, Israel sent the commander of its air force to Moscow to provide the Russians with info about last week's incident, where the Israelis made clear the Syrians shot down the Russian plane long after Israeli jets had left the area. You know, the Russian investigation concluded that while Israel did not shoot down the jet, it was still responsible for the incident. The Russians claimed the Israelis didn't observe the coordination agreements between the two militaries, and their airstrike in Syria put the Russian plane in danger. Today, the Russian Minister of Defense announced a series of new military steps in Syria. In addition to providing the missiles, the Russian plans to equip the Syrian air defenses with automated control systems. That's intended to guarantee that all Russian planes are identified by the Syrians and jamming satellite navigation, along with airborne radars and communication systems of Israeli fighter jets that conduct airstrikes along the Syrian coast.
Well, you know, the Russian Minister of Defense, Sergei Shoigu.
That sounds right.
Does that sound good enough?
Yeah, that's good for us American phonetics.
Yeah, I wonder how the Russians would pronounce Cedarstrom.
It'd be fun to hear. I'm not sure how they pronounce it, but it would be fun to hear the guttural pronunciation.
But he said today that the Russian agreed in 2013 to an Israeli request not to supply the missiles. And so things are getting heated up over there. I don't know if Russia is going to take any stance, or maybe this is it for those missiles being shot down, Dave.
Yeah, I don't know, but the sale of these S-300s will prove to be an eye-opener with the United States Department of Defense.
All right. We are still live. There's been some issues at the production site. The producer is fighting to keep us on the air, so we're going to continue to go through with the central banks are now controlling 10% of the gold market demand. How about that, Dave?
Yeah. I mean, they become big players in the gold market, and that wasn't always the case. I mean, just 10 years ago, central banks were the main suppliers via their policy of dumping gold into the market. However, the central bank strategy worldwide to sell gold into the market to depress the price had quite the opposite effect. For example, a lot of listeners may remember that central banks dumped over 2,600 metric tons of gold into the market between 2003 and 2007. That's according to the World Gold Council. The price of gold nearly doubled from 363 in 2003 to close to $700 by 2007.
And last year, the central bank sold gold into the market was in 2009. That was the last year the central bank sold gold. And it was only 34 metric tons. Since 2010, central banks have been net purchases of gold. Between 2010 and 2017, central banks purchased nearly 3,700 metric tons, or a stunning 119 million ounces of gold. And the central bank gold purchases doesn't seem to be slowing. The World Gold Council just yesterday said that the official gold purchases are now 10% of the total market. And you know, the majority of the official gold purchases during the first half of 2018 came from Russia, Turkey, and Kazakhstan. And what a difference than just a little more than a decade ago when central banks were selling rather than buying. And if central banks are smart, they're going to hold under their gold reserves as they'll need it during these financial meltdown that we are anticipating. Debts, remember, debts like U.S. Treasuries aren't really assets.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of banks and treasuries, debt and what have you, surprisingly, when it comes to credit, Americans are scoring well, scoring the best in a long time, possibly forever. For the first time, the national average credit score has reached 704. That's according to FICO. FICO credit scores, as many listeners know, range from 300 to 850. Your credit score plays a big role in daily life. You know, it can determine the interest rate a consumer is going to pay for credit cards, car loans, and mortgages, or whether they'll get a loan at all. I mean, average credit scores most recently bottomed at 686. That was during the housing crisis a decade ago, when there was a sharp increase in foreclosures, so no surprise there. They've since steadily ticked higher, and now the scores are at an all-time high. Now, that score of 704 I mentioned, that's considered solidly good. Consumers will be qualifying for most credit that they're hoping to get at that rate. You know, any good score is generally above 700. Those over 760 are considered excellent. That's when you get the lowest of the rates out there and the highest amount of available credit.
You know, most people understand that their credit behaviors and their scores are important, and they should check it often, particularly now with the hacking, with what we saw with, what was it, Experian, that had the issues with the hacking. I mean, millions and millions and millions of people. They get no fine. We just talked about it last week, that United Kingdom, those that were affected from the United Kingdom actually sued Experian, fined them. For the breach and the hacking, but nothing out of the U.S. Nope, 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 nope. So it's up to you, ladies and gentlemen, to make sure that you're not being hacked or that your information stays as private as it can be in the world that we live in today, where it seems like nothing is private. So there's been new standards for public records, which stripped all civil judgments and tax liens from credit reports, also played a role in driving the overall average higher. So what we're saying is they changed, didn't they, Dave? They changed the way they report these so everybody has a higher score.
Fancy that.
And particularly as we see credit card balances and delinquencies, they are steadily creeping up as well. And as we gotten further from this recession of 2008, lenders are increasingly competing for new card volume. And part of that is loosening their underwriting criteria in order to be more competitive. So as the number of credit card accounts in the U.S. rises, the majority of new customers are subprime borrowers, generally meaning those with a credit score of 660 or below. And you know, one time, Dave, when you heard about subprime borrowers, they really didn't have that much impact. The point is the number of subprime borrowers that we have in today's world is what makes it so dangerous.
Yeah.
It's, and the amounts.
Well, you know, we know that, Americans avoided probably the most important advice about this, and that's, you know, avoid getting into unnecessary debt in the first place. You know, we have a collective more than $1 trillion in credit card bills due in the U.S. alone. That's just not sustainable. Individually and, you know, combined with student loans and mortgages and our national debt, we're just out of whack. Some tips for improving a bad credit score include always making payments on time, not maxing out your credit card limits, paying down your total debt, which means, you know, just don't pay interest, and regularly check your credit scores, as Melody's reference to last year's Experian crisis, makes it all that more compelling. You know, these tips and other info about this can be found on our Facebook page at DGS Coins. That's at DGS Coins, all one word. Melody.
Well, you know, Dave, some think the Fed's going to raise rates 0.5% this week. Figure it's virtually a lock to approve a quarter point rate this week. And there
you
are
still doubting? Oh no! Listen, hey, you know, I like the contrarian view in general.
Well, that I am. Actually, there's some traders out there that think the central bank could get even more aggressive than just a quarter point. And if they do raise it, it'll be the last one for this year. That I do know. And the only reason I'm saying that maybe they won't is because we know that President Trump has been harping on Powell to keep it. You know, he doesn't like the rates rising. You have the 10-year that's over 3 now, and it's been over 3 now steadily for the past week. So maybe that's not long enough to have an impact, you know, from the Federal Reserve. But if they raise it a quarter point, where's that 10-year going to go?
Well, that's a good question.
So it's going to bring this economy to a, you know, just to a halt. But the markets, I'm sure, are already, you know, they've already built in this quarter point increase. So,
that does seem likely that they have, especially given that this futures market index, you know, says there's a 92% rate that, you know, the rate will be hiked up by 0.25% this week. You know, the range will move up to 2 to 2.25%, the Fed funds rate. But even the 50 basis point hike, you know, is an 8% chance this week. It had been 2 just a month ago. But, you know, that's still, extremely contrarian. I think for some of the reasons Melody just mentioned. So it'll be interesting. Wednesday will be a fun day to be listening in to Financial Survival when we report on the Fed's. I mean, the minutes won't be released, but Jerome Powell will have his post open market committee meeting press conference, and our eyes and ears will be tuned closely to bring you the most up-to-date news that there is to report.
Oh, it's going to be so exciting.
I know.
But 80% of global currencies have fallen since 20, you know, have fallen in 2018. I'm already thinking that we're in 2019. Mm-hmm. There was a review of the values of 143 global currencies, and that indicated that so far this year, more than 80% have fallen in value. Another 11 appear to be pegged to the dollar, and 13 have risen in value. Of the 13 that have increased in value, only 6 are up more than 1% versus the dollar. So there have been outsized declines in countries like Venezuela, that's down 99%, Argentina 53%, and Turkey's even down 38%. But you have Brazil, that's down 20%, Russia 15%. So you have your big economies like China, and they're experiencing a 5% currency value decline, while the euro is only off by 3%.
Now, we can't be sure, but, you know, a lot of people are saying the reason for these declines would appear to be differing monetary policies of the U.S. and the rest of the world. You know, as we know, the U.S. is experiencing solid economic growth as being reported by the government, that is, as well as some signs of inflation, which has led the Fed to raise interest rates 7 times in the last 22 months. You know, whether or not there'll be 5 more increases as, you know, was earlier expectation, obviously remains to be seen. But other nations who aren't experiencing this level of growth are pursuing different policies. Some of them are maintaining interest rates at low levels. You know, there are nations like Germany and Switzerland that still have negative rates in some cases. Japan is close to zero. Plus, many nations are still unwilling to abandon their quantitative easing policies.
Well, you know, and we have to look to see what happens when a nation and their currency declines meaningfully. And it does create problems for the nation's economy. You have inflation increases. And again, we're in a world where all economies are connected somehow, some way, even more so now than in 2008 and even during the Asian contagion. It is far more, economies are far more connected together. So everything makes a difference. And if they're out there trying to balance it, and then there's pressure on interest rates to rise, it's harder to get people to, you know, it's all debt driven. Resources have to be diverted from economic development. It has to be put into financial payments, much of which could be sent overseas. You have external debts, are the funds of a nation and its businesses and citizens owe to lenders outside the home country. If estimates are correct, these countries owe $76.9 trillion in dollar terms. And, of course, those higher rates make that interest and, you know, so much more expensive. Mm-hmm. The biggest countries in Europe, they could have external debt of $40.6 trillion. The U.S. and Canada owe $21.4 trillion overseas. It's amazing. And it's like things just don't seem to matter.
Well, you know, interesting, Melanie, a rule of thumb that came out of this report is that a 1% increase in the cost of debt globally would result in a need to increase interest payments across the globe by $769 billion. Almost a trillion for just a 1% increase. So, you know, in the future when you hear that 1%, I mean, a trillion here and a trillion there, as Dirksen would be saying today, sooner or later, you're talking about real money.
And we're also talking about we're out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Remember, prayers for Pastor Butch Paul. Dave, thank you today. I enjoyed today's program. And 1-800-375-4188. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, be safe, good night, and God bless. I have a plan. If I got me